Hello and welcome to the Happy Hour. I'm your host, Tony Yang, and joining me, as always, are my fellow compatriots, Alex Cortez and Clark Price. How are you both doing today?
Good.
Doing okay, all things considered. It's one of those weird days where a lot of odd things happening, but I'm taking it positive as I can.
Well, odds the new normal, and we'll get into that in a little bit here, but didn't want to update everybody. We've been off the air for a little bit, and part of that has had to do with me, the host and the producer, just the kind of, there's so much to recap on between when we last kind of did our show, which I think was like mid-November and till now. But I will start first with myself, and there are some really ancillarily related topics to this as kind of our catch-up show. But my mother was recently diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer. She had a pleural effusion. She experienced all the complexities of the American healthcare system, good and bad, including some pretty bad healthcare that she received. She had moved out to a somewhat rural area and the hospital wasn't that great. She also had a Medicare Advantage program, which, if you read recent reports, is actually terrible. It does a terrible disservice to our senior citizens and enriches health insurers in particular. And she made the decision, which was easy for her, difficult for us, to go back to Taiwan to seek treatment there. And that took a couple of months to facilitate. So I want to apologize to our listeners or who may have been waiting with bated breath for more of the Happy Hour that they didn't get that. I can assuredly say that this was some of the most difficult and, I want to say, introspective times in the world, in my life. It also gave me a mild gift, which was to take to relieve me of the shock of Donald Trump's victory in the election, since I had to quickly pivot and focus on other things at that moment. But one thing it also did, guys, that we didn't get the chance to talk about because I wasn't around to help facilitate that conversation or put it on the air, was the killing, the assassination of United Healthcare CEO, okay, by Luigi Mangione, who in cold blood killed a United Healthcare CEO, not the CEO of the group, but of the health insurer, which is a subunit of that group. And I believe his name was Brian Thompson, who actually was apparently a reformer with that. But I want to first
Within some relative sense.
Right. Within some,
he was certainly profiting beneficially off of a wantonly bad system.
Right. And the killing sparked, and I kind of want to start here because it's a very interesting inflection point, and goes to Alex saying, his day was weird. I think we've entered a very weird period in our national history. Not just with the election of Donald Trump, but, and certainly many other things that are occurring. But I want to get your thoughts on the killing of the CEO. It was very interesting because there wasn't a lot of sympathy, for the assassination of a healthcare corporation leader in any of this. And so I want to get your guys' thoughts on that. I want to preface it by saying we all condemn violence. That's without question. But, what are we supposed to take away when people don't feel so sorry for the victim of a murder? Clearly a cold-blooded murder.
Well, I think it just shows you that the 1% is like class of its own, where regular people do not connect and feel that personal connection or maybe to some degree compassion.
How about you, Clark?
Well, when you said that, of course, we condemn violence, I thought, yes, of course. And then I thought, but isn't that the key to understanding why there was so little sympathy for Brian, whatever his name was, from
Brian Thompson,
United Health.
Brian Thompson,
thank you. Because violence, it may be considered, comes in different forms. There is the crude kind of delivered violence of a street robbery or a sucker punch in a bar, or somebody being shot in the back. But there is a kind of violence that I witnessed with my own mother, who scrimped and saved to prepare for a time when she would be needy and dependent on healthcare assistance. And she was misled into thinking that if she put these funds into a late in life assistance insurance program, that she would be cared for. And so they said, hey, yeah, you're going to have several hundred thousand dollars of care. And then there was fine print that my mother didn't read. And I just went through her papers in the last few days, and I saw her meticulous attempts of putting money into this program over many years. And then when it was time for them to pay, when she was completely infirm, and of course I was there, and I was looking, I was very happy that I thought, what foresight that you did this. And then it turned out, yes, you have hundreds of thousands of dollars of care. And it was like, it was a lake of money. And then they explained you could only sip it through a straw. We only are going to pay for 8 hours of care a day, and it's going to be, a very inexpensive, untrained person. And so, as it turned out, I mostly me, and with some help from my brothers, but not much. Mostly me taking care of my mother during this period, and it was extraordinarily traumatizing, of course, for her, but also for me.
Right.
And she was betrayed. And then I helped my aunt. My mother died in my arms. My aunt also died in my arms. My aunt was a as I was taking care of both of them. And my aunt was a United Health care member. And in her case, I went through the policy, and I found a number of problems with it. And also, she was having care denied to her arbitrarily. She was a smoker, and so she had some lung problems. And I said, let's go to UC San Diego, and we're going to get you the best person there in their medical center. They have an excellent medical school there, not the greatest medical center, but a lot of those professors are brilliant, and they also practice. And said, no, you can't go there. You have to go to a person in a strip mall. And that's what she did. And I felt that it was a complete ripoff. Now, I don't think, a lot of people don't have sophistication in healthcare. And so she was fine with this doctor in a strip mall until she got really sick. And then the problems accumulated. And so in another way, there was enormous violence done to my family members by the insurance system, which is, first of all, healthcare in America is your money or your life. And the process of illness and dying, especially improperly cared for, is violence. So actually, in this moment, in this program, when you asked that question, I finally understood the rationale of Luigi Mangione. Because normally, I mean, we look at the act, the immediacy of it, and the cruelty of it, and that he left these, he wrote on the bullets, delay, deny, depose. And those, at least two of those words, delay and deny, are the policy practices of right. how you make money by metering out healthcare to people who are in their years of decline. And so I thought what he did was terribly wrong, and I still do, because you can't do it. You just can't. We can't have that. However, I understand, I think, in this moment, I just seem to have put it all together. I think, and this, everyone has this experience. And that's the process of life, because you're born and your parents are, you're young and healthy. And then you're there as they age and age. And because that's another generation above you, you're going to be taking care of them. And this is the reason why Medicare, a big reason why Medicare was created and Social Security was created, is so that the American middle class could thrive and prosper, because otherwise it would be burdened and ruined and bankrupted by the caring for our parents, which we would all, I mean, most of us would do that out of love and concern and compassion. But the idea that Franklin Delano Roosevelt put forward and in Social Security, but he also had the idea of health care would be covered by the state as well. But these ideas took shape, and this is why the middle class came up in the United States, which allowed people to have the greatest number of people to have the highest standard of living in the history of the human race in America in the 20th century, out of the Gilded Age, out of the Great Depression. These ideas emerged. And now where are we going? We're in a Gilded Age that is bigger than the one that FDR led us out of, and that depression that they caused, also with things like what are tariffs which fueled the depression. I know I'm rambling all over.
Well, let me stop you. Having been someone that studied tariffs, let's not say that caused the depression. There are plenty of other reasons that caused the depression.
Oh, it's a contributing factor.
It didn't help. That's that we do know.
That's for damn sure.
Yeah. And but I think you gave a very articulate response to why there was so much sympathy for Luigi Mangione.
Yeah, I kind of figured it out all in a moment because
we all have to experience that, and I experienced it in a microcosm with my mom. She was on one of those Medicare Advantage programs, and it was absolutely terrible. It was not great. And you know,
well, and they often don't know.
No, and that has been the classic problem, I think, here. People don't know their insurance or how to navigate it, and it's very difficult. And even if you give them the ability, even give them assistance, I should say, to navigate it, it's imperfect. There are so many ins and outs to that. This is also complicated by the fact about Luigi Mangione himself. He comes from a family of wealth, of prestige and means. His family owns a country club, golf course. He has cousins that are Republican legislators in the state of Maryland. This is not exactly, you know, some leftist scion. Well, you know,
but you're saying that class dictates your social worldview, and I don't think that's necessary.
No. I'm saying quite actually the opposite. That this is much more disturbing, I think, in some sense, or at least much more intriguing as an episode, because this subverts class, right? I mean, this is one of the elite, right? He went to the Ivies. He went to Penn. And for him, who has all the opportunities of the world, to then turn and give up on his life in some way, that he needs to do this, that he doesn't see a future for himself. I mean, that's a huge indictment. And it's also complicated by the fact of his own medical condition, which is severe pain that from by all accounts he suffered from. And I haven't suffered that before, but we do have someone here who has suffered from a protracted back issue. It does affect your psyche, I think.
It would have to.
Right. I mean, and I'm not being so subtle here, but Alex, I mean, you know, you're as someone who went through some very protracted back pain, and, you know, you did. Thankfully, you don't have it anymore. But maybe you can talk a little bit about the mental state that has over, you know, yours was at least, you know, temporal in the sense that it's only for a couple of years until, you know, you got through it. But, you know, when you're talking about Luigi Mangione, we're talking about spondylolisthesis. I'm sorry, I'm butchering it. And he also had Lyme disease. These are very chronic conditions. But, you know, I mean, Alex, like, I mean, chronic back pain is one of those things that I hear about, or it could drive people mad. Oh, I think we may have lost Alex actually here.
Well, I hope we can get it back.
Yeah, we'll see if he can chime back in here while we're hoping for Alex. But anyways, while we're working on that, Clark, maybe we can we can move on from Luigi Mangione and his manifesto.
Well, I think I don't think we figured out the mass appeal. I don't think it's what I mean, my analysis of it, it's right. Got to be something else. That he has a kind of a Robin Hood thing going on.
He does. But I think the mass appeal is like, I think we all experience healthcare in the way that you had described earlier, that it is an, the, at least in the insurance process, the economic end of it, the access to care of it, the pre, you know, the things like prior authorizations, pre-approvals, balance billing, you know, all these sort of things. We've all known someone that has had to deal with this, right? Because this is unique journey that we all have to go through. And we experience and we're forced to, and this is the important point. I want to get your thought on this, Clark, that we're forced to undergo because of the way that our healthcare system is set up. We don't have a choice because healthcare is expensive. Healthcare is governed by rules and regulations to kind of keep certain things in this place. And we're forced to go through this ugly, painful process while we watch loved ones suffer and potentially die and on their way to death. Right.
Well,
and that is scarring.
It has to. Okay. Out of every dollar that is directed towards a senior through a Social Security, the cost of operation of that is less than 2%.
Right.
That's what it's tremendously efficient. delivery system refined over many years. And by the way, something that Donald Trump wants to destroy. And it's not just him, George W. Bush. And I mean, it's been a dream of Republicans to plunder and vampire themselves into that for a long time. In the case of how healthcare works in this country, out of every dollar, it's probably between 30 to 50% or possibly more.
Yeah.
Goes not to the patient's care, but to the profit aspirations of these companies. And you can see these quote unquote health insurance companies. This health, what do they call them? HMOs, et cetera. And right. That's, there's those three words, waste, fraud, and abuse, that often are Republicans like to associate with government programs they don't like. But waste, fraud, and abuse is systematic. It's systemic.
Right.
In how healthcare works in this country. And you could think, like, what if we had a healthcare system where it was less than 2% to administrate 98% of every dollar, 98 cents on a dollar, to the caring of the patient, instead of what, 40 cents or 33 cents or whatever it is. And the Medicare that goes to a senior in this country, if you make a deal with United Healthcare and they are a similar company, it makes it look as if you are, they're giving you dental, which Medicare wrongly doesn't provide. They're giving you a number of things, but the way they're profiting from that is they take all of your Medicare payment and they make deals with providers, they make deals with pharmaceutical companies to bring the prices as down as far as possible. And also the way that, instead of denying you healthcare that you need, they say they're preventing you from having unnecessary healthcare. That's the service.
Yeah, you know what's unnecessary care? Care to keep me alive, right?
To keep you alive. Yeah, that's right.
What do you mean this is not necessary?
So, I mean, Luigi Mangione is sort of a rogue, actor in this play. People like Michael Moore.
Yeah.
So he did a film called Sicko that Mangione mentions in his, what they call, a manifesto.
Right.
By the way, that manifesto, to me, didn't look like a manifesto.
No,
it looked like a suicide note that he was, and that he planned to kill more people,
right?
More healthcare people, and he was explaining why, in a way that people would read it after he died. And I see the guy as a slam dunk. Guilty as charged.
Oh, I mean, he admits it as much with the documents that he was caught with, right?
Yeah, but there, I mean, he has the one of the best attorneys you can get, and they'll work every angle. Michael Moore made this film, Sicko, that really does it well. And I think there also, I'm just off the top of my head here, I think Mangione references an analysis of healthcare in America by an author named, I think, Rosenthal.
Yeah.
And so this stuff has been well known, well reported, and well studied. But the power of money in America, especially as it gets into politics, and there is no.
Oh, I you know, maybe we'll be able to talk about it today, but like, you know, we, the overarching corruption,
yeah,
of the country by money. I think is
well, and personified by now Donald Trump, who is pay to play all the way.
But before we leave the healthcare thing, I do want to add the context. United Healthcare, it was no coincidence that it was United Healthcare. United Healthcare is one of the insurers that is the most aggressive in terms of prior authorizations and denials. It is one of the worst providers, if you survey physicians, to work with.
Yeah. I think it's the stats bear that out.
You know, they barely pay out. Medicare Advantage programs, the way that they're run, are extremely thin networks, and in order to profit from them, they have to have very small networks. The profitable programs tend to have very thin networks and don't deliver a lot of care. The one Medicare Advantage program that I've seen that actually does what it's supposed to do happens to be Kaiser, and they lose money on that Medicare Advantage program. You know, and so I think that should indicate something about what is happening in the marketplace with that. So I think it's hard to be sympathetic for this type of corporation because we all hate it, right?
Well, let me just say it to anyone listening. If you're at an age where you are about to or are receiving Medicare, I think this, I'm going to be very prescriptive here. Your best deal, which I've learned from direct participation in several cases, is straight Medicare with a supplement.
Yeah, it's famously called the Medigap plans. With it, which covers certain things. You don't get like the nice things like free transportation, but are you going to care about free transportation when you do have something major? When you want to be seen at UC Irvine Medical Center or UCLA?
Let me, by the way, acknowledge and appreciate Alex's hacking and coughing.
I think we have Alex back.
Just to illustrate the
need for medical care
we're caring for. So that would be my prescriptive recommendation: straight Medicare with a supplemental. And then if you can't do that, and there are, I've been in several groups recently that UCLA puts together where we try to help each other. You know, I'm a healthcare patient myself of some special needs. I was born with a problem in my heart, and we have a support group for those kinds of people. And there was a sad woman. She's an adorable woman, and just a sweet. She says, "I just can't afford to go to UCLA anymore." And she actually said, "We just signed up with United Healthcare," and I said, "Okay, please hold the phone here." And then I said to the host of the group, you've got to help her with, you've got to do work something out with UCLA to help her out and advise her, because she apparently had missed all the news about Luigi wow. Mangione. Anyway.
But I want to get back a little
earlier. But I want to say one more thing, that is that if you can't, if you really have a problem, instead of going with United Healthcare, go with Kaiser.
Yeah. Yeah. I did want to sort of say dealing with, I wanted Alex earlier. Do we have you back, Alex? I think we do.
Uh-huh, you do.
Okay. We wanted to kind of like say, you know, at least like to talk about Luigi Mangione's state of mind, that consistent, like debilitating pain. You're someone out of the three of us that's experienced that for some period of time. Thankfully, it's been all resolved, which is great. But like, well, how does that...
Luigi had an accident. It wasn't, I don't think it was degenerative. And then he had bad back
surgery. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, that's right.
But how does that type of consistent pain relief interacting with like the healthcare system, like sort of, how does that affect your psyche, Alex?
Well, I mean, it spiraled me into a big depressive episode. I mean, I couldn't put the actual mental part first because it was that painful. I mean, it made time feel like it ran slower. I couldn't sleep very much, so I do feel like I did lose a good 3 years of my life because they tried to exhaust every other option before going to surgery, and ultimately that's what helped. But
I think it's just difficult because it was like, if I recall that, Alex, like they were recommending surgery earlier, or at least some people were, you know, but they had to exhaust all the other sort of things.
Let the provider.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what's kind of, that creates its own problems within our healthcare system. And so it's interesting that we bring that up because, you know, I took my, to bring this full circle, you know, I bring back my mom to Taiwan where there's, you know, it's universal payer, it's single payer. I'm not saying it's a panacea. It is not, right? The Taiwan has healthcare cost escalations like nobody's business. They don't pay their physicians enough. There's physician and nursing shortages there as well. But if you have something serious like that, there's no friction, right? The doctors can simply prescribe what they want to prescribe and give it to you and do what's best and to practice medicine with the costs kind of contained. And so, you know, that's something to kind of really think about. You know, I think when we think about it, because Taiwan has one of the world's most efficient Medicare systems, 2% administrative overhead. There are debates in Taiwan about like they should pay more because the physicians aren't being paid. It does have some consequences. Some of the physicians in Taiwan see 70 patients a day. I mean, that is an absurd number, you know. You know, so there are trade-offs. But on the other hand, patient care and access is certainly a lot better. And that's I think what we were really talking about. And that's where I think Luigi may have really been trying to kind of get that together. The other thing I wanted to talk about, Alex, since you're back here, is I, you know, and this may get us to the administration and it may not, because we're about halfway through our program. But the fires, that has been a major news issue shortly after the new year. The huge fires that came through, both in Altadena, north of Pasadena, and out in Pacific Palisades as a reflection of both climate change and just a horrific human tragedy and event. I remember hearing about those winds and being very scared about them. But what have you both experienced? Alex first, you know, how have you experienced those winds? And then the fire, subsequent fire.
When the same day the fires broke out, there's been fires breaking out in the river bottom. So I got to witness it just as they had started. I was happened to be driving in and you know, had to kind of be on the lookout in case the spread of it was a risk of evacuation. But luckily it was managed. The fear is always there, especially with as much time as I used to spend in the local hillsides or out in the forest hiking. You can see the state of some of these areas that are just so dry, and that risk is always there, but I mean, I didn't imagine something to this scale, at least. I've seen it in this modern era.
Yeah, I think it's really kind of, well, the tragedy is just huge. I particularly feel for Altadena, because that's a concentration of a lot of African American families. You know, many people from before, right after the war. In World War II in particular. I mean, that's a lot of generational wealth that is now completely destroyed north of Pasadena and areas over there. And Clark, I remember calling you and going like, can you see the fires, you know, from UCLA? And can, you know, I mean, the deep effects within the UC system. I mean, UCLA canceled the first week of classes. It considered evacuating some students away from the dormitories, just because the fires were pretty close to Santa Monica, I thought. So Clark, what were some of your observations as you saw the fire begin to rage and come down the hillsides? I mean, these vicious north winds, which I might want to, which I re-emphasize to everybody, 90 mile an hour winds under uh-huh. which aircraft could not attack it at night. Embers blowing at 90 miles an hour. Nothing, even if you had a sufficient supply of water, could have stopped the firestorm. Could have saved more homes maybe with more water. Could have saved more homes with some better LA Fire Department deployment. But in 90 mile an hour winds, we're talking hurricane force winds coming down from the hills. I don't see it really kind of stopping much. So, but with that caveat.
No, and that's why we have certain really bad actors like Donald Trump who are using the results to justify their results, which are widespread devastation, to justify their political agenda, which is to defame the most successful state in the United States by far. In fact, pretty much, I mean, there is no comparison. And it is also the most progressive, the most liberal, the most democratic state. In fact, it is a supermajority of Democrats. And so obviously it would have to be defamed by people who can't accept the reality of its success and therefore the reality of the success of the Democrats who run the state. So they had to do something bad, and that's what they extracted out of this. If 100 mile an hour hurricane of fire rained down on Mar-a-Lago, there would be nothing left.
Right.
No matter what. That crackpot governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis, would be shown for he can't change the laws of nature either. So the things that they said were preposterous, conditioning aid on the conformance with their beetle-browed simpleton worldviews is just got to be rejected. And at some point, we should, if they really want to make an issue of it, I think that California should consider a conditional declaration of independence, or perhaps, as a minister in Canada said, we'd like to consider, what if you want to take Canada as the 51st state, we'd like to consider California as the eighth province.
is one of the things that it prompts my memory of George Washington, because Washington, when he left in his farewell, urged the country to consider itself not as a group of sections, Northerners, Southerners, Westerners, Easterners, but as Americans, and being and having our fate intertwined with one another.
Well, George Washington was truly a revolutionary, and it is a great mistake for, and a lot of Republicans regard Donald Trump as a revolutionary. He's a counter-revolutionary.
Yes. Yes.
He's fighting to overturn the war that George Washington fought and put the king back into place, the king being him.
Yeah.
That's what he's really trying to do. And let me point out that that scene from the inauguration where there are a bunch of billionaires standing there with the same.
It's what, Alex?
Front row.
Yeah, in the front row.
Yeah. is a mirror of what Vladimir Putin has done.
Yeah.
Well, that's not America right there.
The brotocracy. And we get to that, but I don't want to leave the fires quite away from it in the scope of the tragedy we're talking about.
Unfortunately, everything we talk about, medicine and the fires and our relationship with nature, it's all political. It lives in a political framework.
And let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, the fire recovery, I mean, we're going to have like, you know, we're talking about 30,000-40,000 displaced people plus. And at the moment that they need relief, we have idiot politicians politicizing this. You had Rick Caruso out there, you know, former mayor, mayoral candidate for LA, criticizing the response at a time when clear-headedness needs to be involved, sympathy and compassion for people near involved. Rick Caruso is like, look, I had to save my house myself using private firefighters, right? The irony of making that statement, the hubris of making that statement, I hope it's not lost on people. But this hyper-politicization, right, of everything that should be a normal basic government function, such as disaster relief, it sickens me. It is un-American, and it is all because of Donald Trump. I think there's a lot of anger and resentment that's out there, but I also am frustrated because I'm not exactly sure what to do at the moment. So Alex, how does this all sort of strike you? You know, you're the one that said, you know, you had a weird day. How do these things feed into your moment of weirdness or in there?
Well, I do feel that as much as you, at least I try to, you know, I purposely didn't watch any of the inauguration coverage. I try to see a lot of the news and the things he's up to, the administration's up to. That's right. Just get the digest later. But it's a very. I will say I do feel not as frazzled as the first time he was elected. Right. Well, certainly I am more concerned. Like I know what he's capable of. He had one crack at this already. He's gonna go out and, you know, go after people that have been critical of him. And him, that control or influence by these billionaires that they essentially bought a presidency. It almost seems like Trump is so desperate to be idolized that he goes to extreme measures and doing some pretty messed up stuff.
Well, that's kind of putting it mildly, but Clark, what are your thoughts about this like hyper-politicization of what should be normal? I mean, is that the best way to put it even? Like, these normal things are now weird?
Well, I think, as I said earlier, everything's political. But the thing is, if you have a sense of we're all in this together, And we've created a country, and we've sustained that country for the purposes of doing collectively what we cannot do individually, to live a higher standard of life, to educate, to provide for transportation, mobility, and to realize our full human, or our human potential to the fullest extent possible, what the founding documents refer to as life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And I think that when you recognize that that's what this is about, and it's not something to be conquered, when you win an election, it's not a conquering, and you have the spoils of the conquer. It's you're winning an election for the people, not for yourself. And this is the huge fundamental mistake that Donald Trump makes. And he is not a patriot, because this isn't his country. It's our country. And the way he approaches it, and you can see it in every gesture, in every deed, it's about it's about the United States of Donald Trump rather than the United States of America. And this is the sickness and depravity at the core of his being. And also the way he behaves, a truculent, cruel, spoiled child that never grew up. The way that he was, why can't he, when he is being addressed in church, in that Episcopalian church, by the bishop, saying, have mercy on people who are genuinely afraid, the LGBT community. I pity the, and have mercy on immigrants. This is in the tradition of mankind, is to welcome the immigrant and bring the, and make the immigrant not a stranger, but your friend and your fellow patriot in the country that they've chosen to come to. This is the tradition. He is a perversion, and he is gifted with charisma, and he's gifted with skill as an entertainer, and he has made hatred and zeal for his hatred a popular passion across the United States. And it is a sickness, and it is a madness. And when that old expression, those whom the gods would destroy, they first make mad, we have gone insane, and we are not rational about what this is about.
And I being the most religious member of the group here, not the most formally religiously educated, but I will say that and the Episcopal bishop is Bishop Megan Budde, Budde. She is the bishop of the National Cathedral, so it is her cathedral. She's the bishop. She's also the bishop of Washington, D.C. And she already ran into Trump before, because if you recall, Clark,
The upside down Bible.
That was the upside down Bible, right? Like, let's put this all into context here, and I want to put it into context here, right? Because this is in some sense it's a bit of a witness, but there's a man who held a Bible upside down in front of a church that was aiding George Floyd protesters, assisting social justice, when he cleared them out with tear gas. Now, the Park Service said, we didn't use tear gas. They found tear gas canisters there. And it was Bishop Budde who said, yes, they are using it. And I forgive, please forgive me if I am pronouncing her name incorrectly. So she already picked a fight with that, with him over that. Now, while she has him there, she goes, I want you to have mercy. It's a small thing. I think it's actually very Christian. I think it's all very just it the base of it is the very base, yeah. basic yeah. sort of thing. Asking for mercy. Americans, the American tradition has been to show mercy, right? Whether it's after wars, whether it's to immigrants and that sort of thing. Like that should be a core principle and core value. And then we have the leader, quote unquote, of the free world just sitting there going, yeah, I didn't think that was a good sermon. What do you want us to show?
Well, the thing I objected to was his truculent childishness, the faces, and then later demanding an apology from the Episcopalian Church.
How are you going to demand an apology over something that is clearly in the belief structure of the church, right?
Well, I mean, you're saying how can he demand the apology and be taken seriously?
Yeah.
But he certainly has. I don't think the latter part of that is important to him. He's just a big baby, and he could have sat there and just taken it in. He could have been placid and gracious and well behaved instead of a spoiled and cruel child who became a cruel man.
Yeah.
And he didn't. He's so undiplomatic.
Alex, go ahead.
I mean, it's because the sermon didn't laud him enough.
I don't think that was necessarily the issue for all we know. I mean, there is a bit of a psychopathy here, I think. And
I think that's going to become clear to everyone.
And too late, I might add, for a lot of people. But I think people to be outraged by someone preaching for mercy, particularly from people in power, I think that is just absurd. And it is, you know, the height of hubris to interpret it that way. But I think it's really important that someone said it and someone of faith said it, you know, especially considering that the next day Trump is like, well, they have rescinded the order for Border Patrol. Now you can raid churches and schools, two of the most sacred institutions, sensitive places and vulnerable places. They're going to raid in emergency rooms. I mean, this is just cruelty, as I said famously during the last administration, cruelty is the point. And that's how they're going to try and provoke and change society. I just don't think Americans ultimately will do that, but it is going to be difficult, you know. And I don't find that particularly appealing. But we're coming close to the end of our program. So we do our usual one good thing. My one good thing is having enough emotional and mental energy to come back and start doing this show. I'm grateful my mother is receiving treatment. And I'm also grateful that, you know, we're here finding our voices and continuing to do our programming, which I think is valuable. How about you guys, Clark, Alex, who wants to go next?
I'll go. I mean, what I'll say is, instead of, you know, prayers to your mom and of course that prayers to all the victims of the fires and all the folks that have made vulnerable by this new administration. So let's hope if, you know, there's some kind of divine grace that makes things better.
Yeah. Clark?
I'm my good thing is the career of and the personage of David Lynch as one of the great artists of the spanning the 20th and 21st century. I think he was a remarkable, very humane, very devoted artist. He worked hard. And he felt what he did. He felt art in the way that any everyone ideally should, but certainly as an artist, it was ecstasy. He found ecstasy in his creations, in music, in painting, in film. And although it was often dark, it was beautifully dark and unusually so. And he evoked a kind of dream logic and a dream ambience and situation in a way I'd never seen in film before. And also, he had great taste in movies. He loved film noir, and he loved Billy Wilder, Sunset Boulevard, and The Apartment. Those are, I mean, he liked a lot of the same movies that I like. And he was a big presence, and he is definitely going to be missed, but his influence is probably going to stay around a very long time.
Yeah. So with all that, we're all out of time. I want to thank you for listening. Tune in next time for more of the Happy Hour. Goodbye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye.